Yeah.
I have a related question about this. And what about the permission? So the ethical issue, the permission from the parents, what they're thinking about?
Est-ce que la fréquence des retours des parents auprès de leurs enfants, par exemple une ou deux fois par an, influe sur le maintien du lien? Et dans ce sens-là, est-ce que les nouvelles technologies jouent aussi un rôle éventuellement pour maintenir un peu plus le lien?
Absolument. Dans la partie du projet qui regardait le bien-être des parents, il y a eu une étude qui regardait justement sur qu'est-ce qui détermine le bien-être des parents qui ont des enfants dans le pays d'origine. Et ils ont trouvé que ce qui était aussi très important, c'était un peu de contact face-to-face. Et ça, c'était très important parce que le contact à travers les technologies, c'est naturellement, ça facilite. Mais le problème, c'est que sans le contact aussi, comment est-ce qu'on dit, face à face, le contact virtuel, ça devient de moins en moins. La qualité du contact virtuel. Donc si le parent a eu l'occasion de visiter un fois par un an ou par deux ans, alors le contact virtuel, c'était bien. Mais si le parent n'était pas là pendant 5 ans, 6 ans, le contact virtuel, ça n'aboutit à rien. Et c'est très difficile à avoir une conversation à travers Skype. Et en plus, dans les contextes africains que nous on a étudiés, le contact virtuel, c'était plutôt le téléphone. Ce n'était pas à travers Internet ou visuel.
Skype.
Oui. Et c'était ça que les deux côtés se plaignaient de la superficialité du contact par téléphone s'il n'y avait pas du contact face à face. Et ça, c'était, oui, je pense, important parce qu'au début, la littérature sur les technologies a eu tendance à emphatiser le côté facilitatrice de la technologie, mais il y a aussi l'autre côté. Et dans un des papers que je t'avais envoyé, qui je n'ai pas présenté ici, on discute aussi un peu les difficultés que le téléphone pose pour la personne qui s'occupe de l'enfant. Parce que souvent, ce qu'on voit, c'est que le migrant achète un téléphone pour son fils ou sa fille. Mais comme nous, les mères autour de la table, savons que bon, les enfants, ils peuvent dire parfois des choses, ils peuvent voir des choses que tu fais, ils ne sont pas d'accord. Mais si l'enfant a un téléphone et peut te téléphoner et te dire... ma marraine ou ma tante ne me donne pas à manger. Alors toi, tu es à dizaines, milliers de kilomètres, tu ne peux pas voir. Est-ce que c'est vrai? Est-ce que ce n'est pas vrai? Donc ça cause une grande tension entre les deux adultes, le caregiver et le parent. Donc c'est aussi, il y a aussi des côtés un peu problématiques avec la technologie, pas seulement facilitatrice. Ouais. Et voilà, arrangements with children. Ah, so yes, so indeed. What's interesting is our project was called Transnational Child Raising Arrangements. And indeed, the word arrangement can make it sound like you make an arrangement, you make an agreement, you agree on things beforehand. Yes. But in fact, everything is very tacit. It's tacit. In fact, we had some cases of parents who even left without telling anyone. And the mother of the woman, for example, finding herself...
You have a case on your article.
Yeah. A mother finding herself to have to take care of these kids because their mother disappeared, and then after a week or so gets a telephone call and says, hey, I've reached Europe. Or this idea that because I was fostered when I was a child... you know, of course I can leave my child with someone else. So there's a lot of implicitness and non-spokenness of these agreements, which, but the, they have all sorts of implications and expectations. And so it's so interesting to see how then people navigate these agreements when they don't end up being what people expected.
Yeah, yeah.
And in fact, what we say is that on the one hand, social child fostering is a context that makes it easy because it means that I can leave, I as a mother can leave without feeling that I'm doing anything bad to my child, because it's the context. It's, and I'm sure that my mother can take care of my child. So it facilitates migration. But on the other hand, child fostering has always been operated in a rural to urban context within Ghana. That's how it developed, and maybe within also the region, but not with Europe, and also not with the types of money that's involved. So there are very different expectations from child fostering agreements when they are national or child fostering agreements when they are transnational. And I think people are still dealing with these. So on the one hand, all these tacit implications and tacit expectations, and on the other hand, then sometimes these tensions that emerge. So I think that it's a very interesting area to investigate more. The law in Nigeria, no, the law in Ireland. So it was, I think it was until 2004. Mm-hmm. I'm not 100% sure now anymore about mm-hmm. the date, but it was so that if you gave birth on Irish soil, your child was Irish.
Okay.
And then because your child is Irish, usually the mother could eventually get the Irish nationality. And for some reason, there were already quite a few Nigerians in Ireland. And so this triggered this whole Nigeria flow, because the law didn't say that it was only for Nigerians, it was for anyone.
Yes.
But somehow it was really this huge Nigeria flow that took advantage of this situation. And that created, you know, that engendered a whole, even after once the law was passed that was no longer possible, there was already such a huge Nigerian community that this continued.
Okay. Mm. Okay.
J'ai beaucoup aimé en fait votre présentation. Ça m'a fait vraiment réfléchir sur une recherche que j'ai terminée il y a 2 ans. Moi, mon point de vue, c'est plutôt depuis l'expérience des travailleuses domestiques au Mexique, qui travaillent en interne, qu'on appelle des bonnes en France. Donc c'est une migration à l'intérieur du Mexique, hein, c'est pas une migration internationale. Mais où je m'étais intéressée aux expériences de ces femmes en fait, qui, lorsqu'elles deviennent mères, ne peuvent pas s'occuper de leur enfant parce que c'est tout simplement pas possible dans le cadre de leur travail, il n'y a pas du tout de droit du travail qui leur permet d'accéder à des garderies, etc. Et comme elles sont en général mères célibataires, il n'y a pas un conjoint qui subviendrait aussi aux besoins le temps de les premières années, en fait, on va dire. De l'éducation de l'enfant. Donc c'est depuis ce point de vue en fait que j'ai que j'ai écouté en fait votre présentation. Et c'est vraiment super en fait l'expérience de l'Afrique. Moi j'avais notamment lu le travail de Suzanne Lallement, donc sur la circulation des enfants d'Afrique, et j'ai beaucoup utilisé son travail qui est fait en Afrique pour casser un peu les catégories, parce qu'au niveau du Mexique, on va lire plutôt à la recherche à les Apañas, que j'ai aussi beaucoup utilisé, mais ce n'est pas suffisant.
Ouais.
Donc j'avais besoin de nouvelles catégories. Justement, j'utilisais celle du fosterage, qui était impossible à traduire en espagnol. D'ailleurs, en français, même si on l'utilise, très honnêtement, au niveau de la vie quotidienne, là, c'est pas
assez... Le confiage, voilà. confiage.
Au niveau de l'espagnol, c'est très difficile en fait à traduire avec cette typologie qu'elle est plutôt de la nounou à domicile jusqu'à l'adoption. Finalement, c'était quand même très utile pour discuter des différentes situations. Donc oui, l'Afrique, c'est très différent par rapport au Mexique au niveau des représentations, de la maternité, où c'est beaucoup plus acceptable du coup dans un contexte comme ça que les enfants soient confiés pour quelques heures ou pour des situations plus longues. Alors qu'au Mexique,
c'est quelque chose qui va contre l'ordre moral. Hier, c'était la fête des mères. Donc, la fête des mères au Mexique, c'est la sacro-sainte mère. Voilà. Voilà.
La Virgen de Guadalupe.
Voilà, c'est ça. La Vierge. Voilà. Donc, y a vraiment une rupture en fait, des codes moraux hein, quand on laisse ses enfants lorsqu'ils sont confiés. Donc ça, c'est très difficile en fait, du point de vue des mères, mais du coup aussi des enfants à gérer toutes les émotions qui sont liées à ça et aux représentations, en fait, on va dire dominantes. Donc pour moi, c'est beaucoup plus frais en fait, d'écouter parler de la situation aussi africaine. Ça permet aussi de se dégager un peu de toute cette partie qui est quand même très difficile. Mmh. Quelque chose aussi que j'ai beaucoup aimé de votre travail, c'est parce que on remet à leur place l'importance des personnes qui s'occupent des enfants, les caregivers. Enfin, on dit qu'elles sont importantes. Hein. Ces femmes qui sont toujours en fait dans l'ombre d'autres femmes qui s'occupent des enfants, que ce soit les grands-mères, c'est généralement les grands-mères dans le cas de figure, hein, ou que ce soit les nounous, parce que ces femmes en fait qui migrent en fait pour s'occuper des familles et généralement des enfants font de ces familles.
Ouais.
Elles-mêmes en fait font tout un travail de fosterage. Dans les familles en fait pour lesquelles elles travaillent et ça on voit jamais en fait que ceci de la circulation en fait d'enfants donc, ces femmes migrantes qui s'occupent d'autres donc ça cette importance des figures maternelles on va dire c'est peut-être pas dit en très bon français mais alternative hein, ces autres mères en fait c'est un résultat très très intéressant en fait votre recherche et je trouve ça l'autre grand résultat qui m'intéresse aussi énormément, c'est cette question en fait de la guerre en fait en Angola. Je vous cacherai pas, ça me parle beaucoup parce qu'au Mexique on est dans une situation en fait confirmée depuis 2006 en fait. Et c'est d'ailleurs ma prochaine recherche. Je travaille maintenant sur les populations déplacées en fait au Mexique et je compte travailler avec les enfants de familles où il y a des personnes qui ont été exécutées ou disparues. Donc ça m'intéresse en fait énormément et ça m'a tout de suite parlé forcément quand Béatrice est intervenue, quand on voyait bien que l'Angola ça n'allait pas. C'est cette question en fait du stress post-traumatique hein, et tout ce que ça implique hein, dans la construction de l'expérience des enfants en fait, qui grandissent dans un contexte de conflit armé. Parce qu'en fait ils vont développer, il y aura forcément en fait des pertes, des décès, des personnes disparues en fait dans leur expérience de vie, et ils développent en fait un énorme stress par rapport à la séparation, les peurs d'abandon, de perdre un être cher. Donc voilà, tout ce qui est en fait séparation génère en fait un stress beaucoup plus important. Donc ce qui pourrait être intéressant, c'est de continuer à travailler sur Angola. Avec ces enfants-là en particulier, c'est d'introduire donc de nouvelles variables, je pense, liées en fait au conflit armé. Donc, dans ce qu'ils ont vécu en fait dans leurs expériences, à eux ou celles de leurs parents, parce que c'est transmis de façon de la génération de parents vers eux, les personnes qui ont été décédées et disparues en fait dans leur passé proche, en fait, on va dire, parce que je pense que c'est en fait très important en fait. Et puis bon, voilà, en gros, ce seraient les choses pour moi les plus importantes. Je pense que pour en parler beaucoup plus longtemps, mais
oui,
après,
oui.
Il y a énormément une autre présentation.
Ah, merci, merci. Je peux poser une question? Non, parce que je suis très intéressée aussi, il me semble très intéressant votre recherche maintenant sur les enfants des gens disparus, mais aussi les enfants les déplacés, forcément déplacés, aussi des immigrants internationaux, parce que ça, c'est aussi, il y a tout une grosse population d'enfants qui sont maintenant sans père, par exemple, mais qui vivent aux États-Unis, des enfants mexicains. Et je voulais savoir si ça va être aussi dans votre étude. Et deuxièmement, je voulais savoir si vous avez des méthodologies particulières pour parler avec ces enfants, parce que, bon, ils ont aussi été traumatisés.
Alors, a priori, ça dépendra en fait, des recherches de fonds pour faire un projet collectif. Ou si, si j'ai réussi à avoir ces fonds-là, on prendra en compte les populations déplacées. Si je ne les ai pas, ce sera moi, en fait, toute seule, pour l'instant. Et donc, ce sera plutôt avec les familles de disparus ou avec des familles ou des personnes qui ont été exécutées, en fait. Je vais travailler, en fait, moi, mon entrée, ce sera avec les organisations de droits de l'homme ou de familles de disparus. Et de voir comment, depuis la société civile organisée, il y a des réponses, en fait, on va dire, pour s'occuper de cette population. Notamment, ça fait maintenant 6 ans que je collabore avec une ONG qui s'occupe notamment d'un groupe de familles disparues. Donc, ils ont mis en place une aide psychologique pour ces enfants. Donc, en fait, moi, sans aucun problème, je peux travailler avec eux. Oui. Et donc, il y a toute une équipe de psychologues qui travaillent, notamment avec la thérapie du jeu. Donc, c'est autour du jeu, en fait, qu'on peut s'insérer et avoir, en fait, une place et une mode de dialogue avec eux, parce qu'on ne peut évidemment pas faire du dialogue comme ça, comme l'enfant d'entretien. Et ça, c'est vrai que c'est une vraie question. Et donc, ça sera ma façon à moi aussi d'apprendre à comment communiquer avec eux autour du jeu, pour pouvoir après le répliquer. Je voudrais après travailler dans un internat dans l'état du Tamaulipas. C'est pas un internat, c'est un orphelinat. Un orphelinat d'enfants qui ont perdu un ou deux parents. Donc 200 enfants en fait, dans une ville en particulier de cet état, où je pense aussi travailler, donc d'abord travailler pour l'organisation, apprendre en fait à travailler avec l'enfant pour aller travailler dans un orphelinat. L'intervieweuse interviewée, quoi.
Yes, I would like to ask you a question, but maybe in French.
Oui.
I'm Constance Le Corsier, I'm a sociologist here in Lames Laboratory Mediterranean of Sociology, and I work on absence.
Oh.
I have quite a problem with the term of transnational families, because I think it has a lot of questions, this term, transnational families, especially in this context. So I would like to have your point of view on the use of the term to describe this family and the transfer of some different norms, affects, sentiments.
Mais elle se débrouille pas mal en anglais.
Ça, c'est terrible. So I continue in France. Alors, deux points. Le premier point est. Non, le mot en anglais.
Esperanto, ça va aussi.
Le premier point, c'est sur la famille transnationale. Qu'est-ce qu'on met derrière ce terme transnational? Et comment votre étude, qui inclut la comparaison, permet de comprendre ce qui fait transnational dans ces familles. Et le deuxième point, c'est à propos de cet évaluage d'Emmanuel qui était très intéressant et qui demande à son père des choses, des biens, que son père ne lui donnait pas auparavant et puis après il lui donne en migration. Et je me disais que cette question du bien, de la chose, elle était très intéressante pour comprendre le changement d'enfant à enfant, pour comprendre la diffusion aussi d'une forme de rapport au transnational, une forme de rapport à la façon dont on considère les enfants dans les pays où justement les mères ou les pères peuvent s'occuper des enfants d'autrui. Et donc je voulais que vous reveniez un petit peu sur ces deux aspects de ce qui pourrait constituer la famille transnationale, tant au niveau des valeurs, des normes qui circulent, mais aussi la possibilité de changement que sous-tend ces affects, la circulation de ces affects dans ces contextes-là.
So, at the very simple level, a transnational family is simply a family or people who are tied, feel and describe themselves as a family, but who are based in different nation states. And therefore, when they do family and this circulation of care and affect and emotions, etc., they are forced to do so in particular ways that this distance creates. And the reason why we focus on transnational is because actually in the current contemporary migration, global migration conditions that especially people coming from global south countries to global north countries find themselves in, they're faced with all sorts of impediments, all sorts of laws, all sorts of borders that can be at a geographical border or at another border like an embassy that they have to deal with. And this, having to deal with this, engenders all sorts of practices or new ways of doing things in order to continue to feel like you are a family. So that's, for me, why I talk about transnational families. It's like a very descriptive, it's descriptive, and it's also like a heuristic element, because it allows me to say, first of all, that family doesn't have to be under one roof, which is something that is often done both in family sociology studies that just study families in one house or one in one town or what have you. And secondly, also, so that's the transnational families, but also if you think of just the fields that I'm more familiar with, international development studies, we're always working with the household. And the household are people who eat together, so it implies that they're all together. So for me, it's just something to emphasize that there is this huge distance.
What's the term of trans? Qu'est-ce que le terme de trans apporte pour la compréhension de ces familles éloignées? Question du trans plutôt que la question de l'international, par exemple.
Bon.
C'est oui. Idée de mouvement qui est très intéressante parce que elle questionne sur le sens de cette dispersion familiale. Je vais voir comment.
Oui. Bon. So for me, the trans in the transnational is the links, is the emphasis on linkages. So international is, you don't have to have a link. It's, often studies of international relations or international countries or international organizations, it's all about that they are, you know, operating at some kind of higher level than the national, but it's not emphasizing linkages. So for me, the trans is really saying that just because people are living in different countries and could be international, but there's this thing that links them. And in the case of families, it's doing family. It's all the practices and the emotions and the flow of goods and money and care that creates these linkages that makes people continue to think of themselves as family. So that's, I think, the transnational. That's why it works for me. I mean, yesterday or 2 days ago with Virginie, we were talking about translocal. You can also talk about translocal, not necessarily national. But for me, it's really not, that's not the essence. For me, it's the essence is really saying, look, all of us who are, all these disciplines and all these researchers and this history that we have that has always looked at units as bounded and overlaying perfectly on one space are no longer so. And so we need to talk about them in using different language, and we need to talk about them and we need to study them using different lenses, different glasses. And for me, transnational does it, but it could be something else if you feel that there's another, like I think what you used a term just before. Huh?
Absence?
No.
International?
No. Between absence and international, we should play back. Anyway. Or maybe I may... Huh?
Éloigné.
Voilà. Les familles où les gens sont éloignés l'un de l'autre. OK. C'est bon. Non, pour moi, ça, on peut utiliser aussi les familles éloignées, mais peut-être c'est un peu plus difficile, je ne sais pas. Et après aussi, naturellement, il y a toute une littérature sur la famille transnationale avec laquelle tu veux t'engager. C'est pour ça aussi. Donc ça, c'est mon point de vue sur le transnational. Et le deuxième point, c'était...
Sur Emmanuel.
sur Emmanuel. Ah oui.
Le changement.
Le changement, les... voilà. Alors.
Et l'impulsion du changement par les enfants aussi, à travers ouais. les objets issus.
Oui.
Et la création, peut-être, d'une norme dans les familles qui
se font une faute.
Oui. So it's really, really an interesting question, because on the one hand, and you can see that also in some of the other quotes, a parent who cares for you is a parent who is able to provide. And that provision can be in the form of providing food and clothing and whatever. But increasingly with international migration, that provision might also be... an iPhone or some kind of gadget, and that does create a big differentiation between kids who have migrant parents and kids who don't, for example. Yeah. So it also relates to what I was just saying in reaction to your questions about child fostering. When it was done nationally, doesn't have these expectations of gifts and of iPhones and of this. When it's done internationally, all sorts of expectations then come into play. So that's, I think, a very interesting change. So on the one hand, you have this child fostering that creates a context for parents to say, yes, I can leave him here and I can go on migration. So it facilitates migration. And there's some kind of implicit, tacit agreement that this can happen and it's okay. And on the other hand, international migration then provides a completely different context for this child fostering. And then suddenly there are all sorts of different expectations that come on board, which give it a completely different... I mean, you can't even call it child fostering what happens, because the parent continues to be very engaged in the child's upbringing. Whereas in the traditional child fostering arrangements, no, the parent, you give it to your sister, and then it's your sister who decides where the child goes to school. It's your sister who provides for the child. In international migration, it's the parent who has to continue providing. So completely different expectations. But at the same time, it's almost like parents are trying to figure this out. As we're, on the one, they leave with these expectations of old norms of child fostering. Then they find themselves in a completely new situation with very different expectations. And we're in this phase of, I think, this transition phase where we're going from this more historical form of child fostering to this international or transnational form of child fostering. I think that's a very interesting thing to study, how these expectations and norms are changing due to international migration. And Ernestina Danci, the second author of the second publication, has written something on this. And I think Cecilie Oyen also wrote something on this in the case of Angolans in Portugal. And Danci did it for Ghanaians. But I think it's an emerging field. Yeah.
Valentina, before we close, I would like to add also a few comments. Thank you very much for this so clear presentation, because you are not complicated at all. So the presentation, so simple, and all the relevant cases with the color, with the stars.
Very pedagogic.
There's a lot of work behind that.
I have many ways to reflect on how I have questions about mobility.
Mm-hmm.
Because in all this work, you were taking kids that were located somewhere. So maybe it's a link to your new project now.
Mm-hmm.
But those kids, because you say traditional fostering was from rural to rural urban areas, with kids staying in rural areas,
mm-hmm.
and parents moving to towns. And so maybe in the rural areas, there are maybe family ties are more... sustained, so maybe it's more easy to have also child fostering in rural areas than urban areas. So I wanted to know if you had that somewhere in your study. But the other thing is the mobility of the child.
So if the child stayed, when you interviewed the children, did the children live in the same city where the parents, where they were living before their parents left, or did the children move from one place to another? And I'm thinking also about the war, because maybe in the Angola war, children have been displaced because of the war, so maybe this mobility affects their well-being, and maybe not the fact that the parents left, but maybe because also they moved, so they lost their friends, so they had to get into different, to get adapted to a new world, that was maybe their world. So, and maybe, and I was also wondering if you had cases of children children who were sent to other countries, like not the mobility of the parents, but also the mobility of the kids, which happens sometimes in the fostering outside the country. I have this question because I have a PhD student who's presenting his thesis next month, and he has he's working with a group of people coming from Bangladesh, from a very specific region of Bangladesh, where due to the war, 30 years ago, some kids, like 80 kids, were sent to France and separated from their parents and placed in different families in France just for waiting for, didn't know for how long. And the parents who received those kids didn't know if the kids had parents or not, because they were living in a boarding school with Buddhist monks. So it was not clear whether they had parents or not, and family didn't always know what was happening. And there were children between 8 and 15 years old. And 30 years after, so the study is now about those 80 kids who arrived 30 years ago. And so some of them were adopted by the families. The great majority of them went back to Bangladesh when the war ended. And 2/3 of them are married with Bangladeshi women that they brought to France. And what I found, and they have four parents. Many of them have four parents. So when you said that children who said, I have 2 months, those old kids also were in a situation where they had new parents sometimes. And also the well-being of those kids also depends on what could they tell to the new family, what would they know about the other families, also about the narratives of those kids. So, well, all this is a bit mixed, but one of the other things I wanted to emphasize is whether if you have an idea of how the narratives, the way migration is also presented, told to the kids, presented to them, might affect their well-being. Because if your parent is coming next year, and comes back, or if he... if he explains things to you, if the project is clear or the project is not clear, it might have great differences also on well-being of the children.
Yeah.
And it resulted in the study of Paul that the family, the children who got really in trouble in France had situations which were not clear about which. Couldn't know about the family, who couldn't say about it, and that were one element. So it's just a small, it's not a real result, it's just something he noticed on the evolution of the kids.
So he went back to Bangladesh to interview some of them went back to Bangladesh after the war.
No, they traveled to Bangladesh to meet their families. And 2/3 of them married Bangladeshi women and brought them to France and started to build a transnational community of rural Bangladeshi people who are called the Juma, it's an ethnic minority in Bangladesh, in France, and maintain or not maintain ties with the families over there, but it's very interesting that those kids who were in France completely separated from Bangladesh during more than 10 years, because the first 10 years they couldn't go back, because there was a war and there were places in those families, and after the war, first the NGO who brought them in France organized a big trip to Bangladesh, which allowed them to find some of the parents, and 20 or 30 kids participated in that trip. And after that, that started the reencounter of these adolescents or young men, because there were all men, no women. They wanted to learn the language back, because some of them had lost it, some of them had kept it, but some of them didn't. And it's then another story started, and the thesis is about the whole story. Because the person who did this PhD was one of the parents who received one of these boys.
Oh.
So he's a retired PhD student.
Oh my God.
Yeah. He's a retired professor who did this and when he retired, because he wanted to understand a bit more about his son and the group of children.
Wow. A retired professor, you said?
Yeah, retired professor of secondary school.
Okay. Interesting, very interesting. I'd like to receive the thesis.
I should have invited you to the committee. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it really very fascinating. So indeed, I think that the mobility of children is extremely important and under-researched, also because we make so many assumptions about children. We assume children to follow their parents. And we assume that they are, or if they don't follow their parents, then they will reunify with their parents, at least for international migration. Or if they don't, then we assume them to be stay-behinds, left-behind kids. That's the group I was talking to you about today, and I hope you noticed I never used the term left-behind, because I don't like that term, because it's negative. It seems like they're just abandoned, they're left behind, and when in fact, one of our very interesting findings from the parents is that it was the most highly educated, documented Ghanaian migrant parents who actually actively decided to send their children back to the best elite boarding schools of Ghana, where they were going to get an English language education. They were going to be taught proper norms, being respectful to your to the elders, not the way that the Dutch school system allows them to be so, you know, and they always are teaching them to negotiate. Dutch kids are like always negotiating with their parents. I know. From personal experience. And they don't appreciate this. So they send them back. And these kids then, after they finish these elite schools, which are based on the UK system, have, you know, access to the best schools, Anglo-Saxon schools. So they go off to university in Canada, in the US, and in the UK. So it's actually a conscious first choice. Your transnational family is your first choice solution. It's not a second best solution. It's already there, you know. And that implies all sorts of mobility that is not attached to the parent. So even these left behinds, some of the things that we were discovering is that some of these left behinds were actually moving and going for summer vacations to visit their parents when there was a legal situation. So that's what gave rise to this next project that I'm going to be doing, which is about the mobility trajectories of young lives. These young kids from Ghana, we're going to follow, and we want to know more about their trajectories. And I have a PhD student currently working on one of these case countries. But you see, this is, we gave her a pseudonym, Kristen's mobile trajectory. So Kristen is born in 1997 in the Netherlands in a small town that's called Woerden, and was living with her mother. That's the very beginning of the thing. Then when she was 1 year old in 98, she moved and went to a village
in Ghana and was living with her maternal auntie, so her mother's sister, and lived there until 2002. Then she went back to her mother. Then she went back to the maternal auntie. Then she moved to Accra, to the maternal grandmother. And then she moved back to her mother, who in the meantime had moved to Amsterdam. And the father had always been in the United States, and then she took a summer vacation to the United States. Okay, this is Kristen. Now, if you officially, if you look where she was born, she's born in the Netherlands, so she is what is called a second generation migrant, right? Mm-hmm. But calling her second generation says nothing about all of this, tells us nothing. And if we were to interview Kristen today in 2015 in Amsterdam, and which is what most studies on migrant children do, they say, okay, you're a second generation kid, you're in Amsterdam, you're living with your mom, that's your situation, boom. So we would not come to know anything about the role of the maternal auntie. We would come to know nothing about the grandmother, the maternal grandmother, etc. So I think that what you're pointing to is extremely important. There's a lot of mobility of kids. There's a lot of mobility in the origin country, which in this case is not origin because she's officially in the Netherlands, but let's say Ghana. There's all this mobility, which we also never capture, because we presume that left behinds are just left behinds and they're just in one place. So I think that that is key to trying to understand better how migration impacts young people, is by looking at their actual mobility. And I don't think there is much that really tries to, you know, in a very consequential, systematic way, tries to really analyze how all of this mobility impacts the lives of kids. And forget about the longitude. I mean, that's, you know, that's, yeah, it's not even, it's just not there. So I think that's, so I'd really like to see his, Paul's thesis.
Which is a very, very specific case.
Yes, but it's, I think it's, that's how we start, through empirical cases.
Yeah. But it makes me think of the work of Robert Smith between Tijuana and Mexico.
Yeah.
And New York.
Yeah.
And he follows these persons
over time.
He met during his PhD thesis for 20 years or 25 years. So, and he captures the mobility of the children of those people and how they can be sent back to the country,
yeah,
to Mexico if they get bad in the city, and for not only for vacation, but sometimes for several years, and how the second generation is completely connected and might have different mobilities, long-term mobility or short-term mobilities with the origin.
Exactly. So I think we have glimpses of this from the anthropological literature.
Yeah.
So we know that there are things that happen, like parents sending their children back, etc. But I haven't, and correct me if I'm wrong, or maybe you know of some studies, I'd love to know if you do know, I haven't seen a study that really focuses on this as the main object of study. It's more like in talking about families, they say, oh, these parents send the children back, but if you know of any study that focuses on this, please do let me know, because it would be, and sometimes, as we noticed 2 days ago, you know, Africanists are always talking about Africa, and Latin Americanists are always talking, and the trains never meet, so it's good if we, if you know of anything, please do let me know. Yeah.
I think we can do a bigger pause.